for the corporations. www.billionairesforbushagore.com.
I've got to find another tax loophole for those rich donors before Bush's next fundraising dinner.
We're going to need more campaign cash in November. How can I make the Democratic platform even more corporate friendly?
I know.
What if?
Hey! You got Democrat in my Republican.
Hey, you got Republican in my Democrat.
Not much difference, actually.
Yeah, two bland tastes that almost taste the same.
Paid for by Billionaires for Bush or Gore. We don't care who you vote for. We've already bought them. BillionairesForBushOrGore.com.
Could be Gore.
Should I vote for?
Gore. We don't care who you vote for. We already bought them.
Paid for by Billionaires for Bush or Gore. Because inequality is not growing fast enough.
www.billionairesforbushorgore.com.
Who are you voting for?
Oh, I've already voted.
What do you mean you've already voted?
I've already voted.
The election is until November.
No. Not that kind of vote. I voted with my money.
Really?
Oh, yes. These days, people don't vote. Money does. You see, Bush and Gore need tons of cash to run for office. We've got it. And we can get it to them. It's all completely legal. And in exchange, they basically set their policy agendas around our needs. Both of them. It's much more cost-effective.
What if you don't have that kind of cash?
Oh, it's okay. Just wait till November.
Paid for by Billionaires for Bush or Gore. Because it doesn't really matter who you vote for. We've already bought them. www.billionairesforbushorgore.com.
Forget about stocks. Forget about bonds. There's a lucrative new investment arena. Legislation. A good mutual fund might return 20% a year. But in the low-risk, high-return world of legislation, your investment dollar can return over 100,000%.
Us folks at the tobacco industry spent $30 million in campaign contributions for a tax break worth $50 billion. The return on our investment, 167,000%.
Here's how it works. With the help of a professional legislation broker called a lobbyist, you place your investment, called a campaign contribution, with a carefully selected list of legislation manufacturers called members of Congress. They go to work, crafting industry-specific subsidies, inserting tax breaks into the tax code, or giving away public property for free. The effect on your bottom line is immediate and huge.
For a paltry $5 million in campaign contributions, we here at the broadcasting industry were able to secure free digital TV licenses worth $70 billion. That's an incredible 1,400,000% return on our investment.
If you can get this kind of return when you buy a bunch of congressmen, just imagine what you can get when you buy the president. Don't wait. Invest now and let the paybacks roll in for the next 4 years.
Paid for by Billionaires for Bush or Gore. Because it doesn't really matter who you vote for. We've already bought them. www.billionairesforbushorgore.com.
And now, a preview of this year's presidential debates.
Vice President Gore, how you feel about keeping the minimum wage below the cost of living?
I think it tastes great.
Governor Bush?
I think it's less filling.
Vice President Gore, what do you think about ignoring human rights in China and approving permanent normal trade relations with no conditions?
Tastes great.
Governor Bush?
Less filling.
And how do you feel about tens of billions of dollars in taxpayer giveaways to huge corporations?
Well, so far, it's tasted great. I feel that it's less filling.
Brought to you by BNS for Bush or Gore. Because it doesn't really matter who you vote for, we've already bought them.
And there you have it. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. Call in number 427-3772. We are awaiting your calls here if you want to get in touch with the community and let us know who do you favor in this race, either locally for city council or, if you wish, at a national or state level. 2 days till election. What are your thoughts? Now, I have before me a book that... I haven't completely read, but I was reading last night and found very interesting. It's called Al Gore, A User's Manual by Alexander Coburn and Jeffrey St. Clair. Two guys I really enjoy reading. Occasionally you find him in the New York Times. Occasionally you find him in the, well, regularly you find them every week in the Anderson Valley Advertiser, which, by the way, can be bought locally. There are only two stores I know of, the Capitola Book Cafe, which usually only has one or two copies, and the Book Loft, which is at Soquel and Seabright. Anyway, Coburn and St. Clair write a book about Gore, and they have a chapter called War on the Poor. I'm going to read a little bit from that. This is for all you, I think we're mostly talking to Nader fans out there, but when they tell you that a vote for Nader is a wasted vote, and that Gore is really a sweet guy with a lot of differences and meaningful distinctions from Bush, well, here's some ammunition for you. There were two items that towered above the rest in Morris's assaying of public opinion, and Morris was the PR man and advisor to Gore and Clinton, Dick Morris, in the mid-90s. In the 1992 campaign, Clinton and Gore had pledged to end welfare as we know it. They had also blustered on the issue of crime. In 1993, Gore had urged a war on welfare as part of the first 100 days and had implored Clinton to let him lead the charge. After all, Gore argued, he was one of the few Democratic senators to have supported a welfare-to-work law narrowly approved in 1988, forcing states to require parents getting welfare checks to work at least 16 hours a week in unpaid jobs. But Hillary thought an attack on welfare would divert energy from her health package, and Gore lost the battle. By 1995, the welfare rolls were shrinking, from a peak of 18 million in the recession of 1991 to about 12.8 million. Defenders of the system in Clinton's cabinet, Labor Secretary Robert Reich and Donna Shalala of Health and Human Services, argued that the total budget for aid to families with dependent children, AFDC, was a tiny fraction of the federal budget. Indeed, it was only 14% of the amount devoted to Medicare, a middle-class entitlement. The real problem, they argued, was lack of training for the chronically underemployed and unemployed. Reflexively hostile to welfare and fortified by Morris's polls, Clinton, further fortified by Gore, pressed ahead. The administration began granting waivers to states to implement their own onslaughts on welfare, featuring, quote, workfare requirements, time limits, and, quote, family caps, a punishment to women who dared to have more than the approved number of children the government would help support. Through 1995 and early in 1996, the Republicans had passed and sent to Clinton two welfare bills. He vetoed both, stressing that he agreed with much of their content and principle. Peter Edelman, a high-level official at Health and Human Services, described this as the squeeze play, whereby Clinton would reap approval from Democratic New Dealers for standing up for poor kids, while at the same time signaling that, in the long run, he'd throw the mothers of those kids off the rolls altogether. As they approached the Democratic convention in the summer of 1996, Clinton was floating on Morris's magic carpet. Again, this is Dick Morris, the man who was running government by poll from the White House. Assisted by staggering blunders from Gingrich and a lackluster candidate in the form of Bob Dole, Clinton was ahead by no less than 27% in the polls. The Republicans were eager to wrap up their legislative work before the conventions in July and August. They pushed through a welfare bill arguably worse than the ones Clinton had already vetoed. Many Democrats on the Hill thought Clinton would veto this bill too, but Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan of New York had more sensitive political antenna. He warned, "I've heard that the leaders of the cabinet recommended a veto, but that the president remains under the sway of his pollsters." On July 30, 1996, Clinton mustered his cabinet to hear arguments on whether or not he should sign the Republicans' anti-welfare bill. One by one, his advisors said he should not. No's from people like Shalala and Reich came as no surprise, but similarly disapproving were not only Laura Tyson, his chief economic advisor, but Leon Panetta, Henry Cisneros of HUD, and even Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin, who said that too many people would be harmed by the bill and that it would be an act of political courage to veto it. Not trusting Shalala's department to produce objective assessments of the consequences of the bill, the White House staff had commissioned a survey from the Urban Institute, a D.C. think tank. The numbers were dire. The bill would push 2.6 million people further into poverty, 1.1 million of them children. In all, the Institute predicted that 11 million families would lose income. That was the best-case scenario. In the event of a recession, the numbers would be far worse. In that fateful cabinet meeting, Rubin invoked this study, and the numbers seemed to find their mark with the president, while Gore remained mute. The meeting came to an end, and Clinton, Panetta, and Gore headed for the Oval Office. All accounts agree that first, Panetta again made the case for a veto, vetoing the bad Republican bill that would end welfare, laying particular emphasis on an appalling provision in the bill that would deny legal immigrants federal assistance, such as food stamps. That's not illegal immigrants, that's legal immigrants. Finally, Gore broke his silence and urged the president to sign the Republican bill. Clinton, Morris, and Gore prepared a press statement delivered by the president that same day. Clinton admitted that the bill had, quote, serious flaws, but went on to say, "This is the best chance we will have in a long time to complete the work of ending welfare as we know it." No one at the press conference quizzed Clinton on this curious claim. After all, the election was only about 3 months away. The Democrats had a chance of regaining the House. Would not that recapture afford a better chance of crafting a welfare bill not composed by Gingrich and the others? To this day, many Democrats in Congress become incensed on the topic of what Clinton and Gore did that day. On the eve of a Democratic convention, with Gingrich already ensconced in the national imagination as the bad guy, Clinton had just made common cause with him, thus undercutting all plans to campaign against the Gingrich Congress. As for Al Gore, the consensus was that he was looking ahead to a possible challenge in 2000 from his old rival Dick Gephardt. With Morris's polls showing an attack on welfare to be well over the 60% bar, and that's what Dick Morris, the pollster and advisor to President Clinton, was putting out. He would take polls on issues, and those which had more than 60% support by the public, he would push for. Gore would have the advantage over Gephardt, with the latter lamely defending public entitlements. Suspicions about Gore deepened as the fall campaign proceeded. The president and vice president argued that it was crucial that they be reelected so they could fix the problems with the welfare bill that they had just signed. The problems here concern not the welfare bill, but the denial of federal services to legal immigrants and a slash in the food stamp program. In October, with the presidential election no longer in doubt, Democratic candidates came to the Democratic National Committee urgently seeking infusions of cash to help them in the final weeks. Finally, Senator Chris Dodd of Connecticut, then the general chairman of the Democratic National Convention, or Democratic National Committee, organized a meeting with Clinton and Gore. Dodd explained that the two were home safe and that there was a chance to recapture the House. Clinton seemed amenable to a release of funds to help recapture the House of Representatives. Gore, however, adamantly disagreed. On one account, he was the only person in the White House to oppose this transfer of funds from the presidential campaign to congressional races. It's a measure of how a number of Democrats view Al Gore that some participants in that meeting felt that the only explanation for Gore's conduct was that Gore did not want the Democrats to recapture the House because victory would elevate Gephardt to the prominence of Speaker of the House. The cynicism may not have stopped there. Why did Clinton and Gore decide to sign on to that third Republican anti-welfare bill? The only major difference from the previous ones, which Clinton vetoed, came in the form of the denial of federal services to legal immigrants and a $25 billion cut in the food stamp program, making that the worse bill than the previous two bills which Clinton had vetoed. It's likely that these two Republican add-ons were what allured the White House because, as noted above, Clinton could then turn to the liberals, saying they needed him to be reelected so that he could repair part of the damage which he himself was wreaking, wrought by the very bill he had signed. In fact, the White House probably could have insisted that the Republican riders be dropped, because Dole wanted a legislative victory under the Republicans' belt. The welfare bill that Gore steeled Clinton to sign ended the federal entitlement that had been a cornerstone of the New Deal. It caps the federal contribution to welfare programs at $14.6 billion a year and hands the money over in block grants to the states to distribute as they see fit. The main requirement is that the states agree that welfare recipients can spend no more than a total of 5 years in their lifetime on welfare. It allows states to adopt even harsher standards. Finally, under the old system, welfare money came to the recipient as cash. Under the new system, the money can be given to intermediaries for possible conversion to other services, such as housing or food. Al Gore particularly liked that provision. In Atlanta, in May of 1999, he told an audience why. It allows faith-based organizations to provide basic welfare services. That's religious organizations, folks. They can do so with public funds without having to alter their religious character. That is so often the key to their effectiveness. We should extend this approach to drug treatment, homelessness, and youth violence prevention. People who work in faith and values-based organizations, and those are code names for religious organizations, are driven by their spiritual commitment. They have done what government can never do, provide compassionate care. Their client is not a number, but a child of God. That's all a quote from Al Gore in May of 1999. We're reading from Al Gore, A User's Manual by Alexander Coburn and Jeffrey St. Clair. In other words, treat welfare payments like school vouchers. How about a block grant to Jimmy Swaggart or to Al Tired of Being Alone Green's Church in Memphis, where the Reverend Al regularly denounces gays? It was Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. Not long after Clinton signed the bill, judgment came from Senator Moynihan, who had begun his service to the state back in the 60s with sermons about the pathology of the black family and now, bizarrely, was defending the system he denounced for years, the welfare system. Even this man of all seasons and all masters was shocked. He said, Daniel Patrick Moynihan said, "It is a social risk no sane person would take, and I mean that. If you think things can't get worse, just wait until there are a third of a million people on the streets. It's not welfare reform, it's welfare repeal." Hugh Price, president of the National Urban League, called the bill an abomination for America's most vulnerable mothers and children, and accused Clinton, Gore, and the Congress of defecting from a war on poverty and waging a war against poor people instead. Within weeks, three high-ranking officials in the Department of Health and Human Services had resigned: Mary Jo Bain, Walter Primus, and Peter Edelman. That was it. Across the length and breadth of the Clinton administration, only these resignations were tendered in principle against this abandonment of the New Deal and the shafting of America's poor. Since that time, Edelman has missed no opportunity to denounce the bill as a punitive strike against defenseless people. "The bill," said Edelman, "closes its eyes to all the facts and complexities of the real world and essentially says to recipients, get a job." The edict, get a job, was central to the bill and to the mythology nourished by opponents of welfare that freeloaders with jobs available to them were abusing the system. Of course, there is always some abuse, but study after study had shown that most welfare recipients had looked for jobs and couldn't find a suitable one, or had been on welfare for a limited period, then found a job and got off the rolls. In 1999, a University of Michigan study making an assessment 3 years after the welfare bill found that the welfare population faces, quote, unusually high barriers to work, such as physical and mental health problems, domestic violence, and lack of transportation. More than 30% of the families that are on welfare are constrained by disability, a sick child, no child care, or an infirm relative, and those that want to find work are faced with narrow options even in an economy hyped as in mid-boom. In 1996, the Congressional Budget Office offered some bleak realities about the reserve army of the unemployed. With an official unemployment rate of 4%, the unofficial rate is roughly twice that, since government figures don't count frustrated people who have given up looking for work, there are still 3 to 5 people needing work for each available job. In times of recession, this ratio rises to more than 10 to 1. In urban areas, the job market is even more constrained. A 1998 study in Harlem showed just how brutally competitive the low-wage job market is. Over a 5-month period, an average of 14 people applied for each job opening at a local McDonald's. A year later, researchers from the University of Chicago found that 73% of those same job searchers still hadn't found work. In many states, there's the last resort of workfare, which compels welfare recipients to accept public jobs, such as the highway cleanup or garbage picking with the Parks Department, in return for benefits. Some states and localities call this job training. Nationally, the average benefit for workfare jobs is $381 a month, which works out to $4.40 an hour, or 80% of the minimum wage. But in some places, it's much worse. Mississippi, for example, requires single parents to work 20 hours a week at $1.38 an hour, and a two-parent household to work 55 hours at 50 cents an hour. On top of this, people in the workfare labor force are denied such basic rights as collective bargaining, unemployment insurance, the earned income tax credit, and Social Security credit. States are finding it to their budgetary advantage to fill job vacancies with these slave fare workers. A Senate study in 1996 estimated that this consequence of welfare reform would depress the wages of the working poor by 12%. Allowing the states to freelance their welfare programs has resulted in some particularly cruel policies and inequities. Minnesota spends $50 million a year on child care for single mothers receiving welfare benefits who are working or looking for work. New York spends $54 million to serve a population six times as large. Gore has repeatedly touted Indiana because its welfare program was initiated and implemented by a Democratic governor, Evan Bayh, and his successor in the governor's mansion, Frank O'Bannon. The pair has proceeded over the shrinking of Indiana's welfare rolls by 30%. But there's no way to know if these people actually found work. It's possible that the conditions of supervision of welfare recipients simply became unbearable, and they left the program and perhaps the state. Under Indiana's scheme, one missed job training course means the loss of a welfare check for 2 months. A second infraction means the loss of benefits for a year, a third strike, and you're out. The welfare reform bill includes a provision that allows states to begin drug testing welfare recipients. In theory, the provision was aimed at people suspected of having drug problems. Oregon initiated a testing policy but soon reversed course when recipients began dropping out of the welfare program in order to avoid testing. The state found it was better to stop drug testing, keep people in the program, and steer addicts into treatment. Michigan took a different approach. In 1999, the state adopted a mandatory drug testing policy for all welfare recipients, which prompted a lawsuit brought by the ACLU. A federal judge ruled in 1999 that the policy was unconstitutional. He noted that in the 5 weeks of the program's operation, there were positive drug tests in only 8% of the cases, and all but three of those were for marijuana. In the first half of 2000, Gore campaigned with a call for welfare reform too, saying that more remained to be done to weed out cheats and freeloaders. He was particularly vehement in attacking dads behind on child support, saying that he will make it easier for credit card companies to deny credit to such fathers. This would come on top of a program initiated by Janet Reno in her Florida years, whereby fathers behind on their payments get their driver's license lifted, meaning that they can't go to work. In 1995, Clinton, Gore, and Morris put into operation a program that saw these fathers' mugshots up in post office walls, their federal benefits garnished, and the IRS on their tail. This pattern of inflicting administrative conviction outside the court system and due process is integral to Gore's philosophy on crime. And you're listening to Bathrobes, Pierres, Broadsides. I'm your host, Robert Norse, and this is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. We have a call-in number in case you wish to comment or ask any questions. 427-3772. I'm reading to you from Al Gore, A User's Manual by authors Alexander Coburn and Jeffrey St. Clair, Chapter 12, War on the Poor. And I'm going to read a bit more because I think it's worth knowing before people go vote on Tuesday. The Crime Bill of 1994 introduced mandatory life imprisonment for persons convicted of a third felony in certain categories. It maintained the 100-to-1 disproportion in sentencing for crimes involving powder versus crack cocaine, even though the U.S. Sentencing Commission had concluded that this disparity, i.e. someone caught with crack getting a penalty far, far harsher as that of someone caught with powder, is racist. It expanded to 50 the number of crimes that could draw the death penalty in a federal court, reaching to crimes not including murder, the broadest expansion of the federal death penalty in history. Pell grants giving prisoners an avenue to higher education were cut off. Federal judges were stripped of their powers to enforce the constitutional rights of prisoners, and the power of states to set sentencing standards for drug crimes was diminished. This curtailment of states' rights went further. Grants for new prisons contained the provision that the receipt of the money was dependent on the states ensuring that prisoners served at least 85% of their sentences. These inmates, remember, had been convicted in state, not federal courts, so this was simply federal blackmail to curtail parole at the state level. The Clinton administration also pressed the states to try juvenile offenders as adults. Gore articulated the administration's position. Quote, "When young people cross the line, they must be punished. When young people commit serious, violent crimes, they should be prosecuted like adults. Nonviolent offenders were to be sent to boot camps. Not, it should be noted, his own kids, who evaded punishment for nonviolent infractions, such as smoking marijuana and having an open alcohol container in the car." Gore was particularly assiduous in his assaults on the Fourth Amendment, protecting citizens against unreasonable searches and seizures. In 1994, Gore successfully pressed for a bill requiring all communications providers to make existing and future communication systems wiretap ready. He also pushed hard for the so-called Clipper chip, an encryption device that makes it easy for law enforcement and intelligence agencies to snoop on private messages. The high water mark in the Clinton administration's attack on the Bill of Rights came in 1996 with the Counterterrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which, among other horrors, allows the INS to deport immigrants without due process and denied prisoners appeals to the federal bench based on habeas corpus petitions. "When historians write the story of civil liberties in the 20th century," said Ira Glasser, head of the American Civil Liberties Union, "they will say that the Clinton administration adopted an agenda that has everything to do with weakening civil rights and nothing to do with combating terrorism." In May of 2000, Gore outlined his campaign posture on crime and drugs in another speech in Atlanta. The erstwhile dope smoker from Tennessee, Al Gore, evidently feared that the man who refused to discuss cocaine use in his early years, George W. Bush, had the edge on the crime issue. Gore proclaimed he wanted to swaddle communities, quote, "in a blanket of blue." He swore that the minute he settled into the Oval Office, President Gore would call for 50,000 more cops, that is, more half-trained recruits, like the ones who shot Amadou Diallo 41 times in the Bronx, and would allow off-duty cops to carry concealed weapons, which they almost all do anyway. Gore promised prisoners, quote, "a simple deal. Before you get out of jail, you have to get clean. If you want to stay out, then you better stay clean. We have to stop that revolving door once and for all. First, we have to test prisoners for drugs while they're in jail," end quote. Gore was so blithe in his disregard for elementary rights that he was unable to see a distinction between a prison sentence fully served and a further punitive add-on. Quote, "We have to insist on more prison time for those who don't break the habit." Even after prisoners are released, the eye of the state would still follow them. Quote, "We should impose strict supervision on those who have just been released and insist they obey the law and stay off drugs." Another feature of Al Gore's prospective war on crime was the especially vigorous targeting of minority youth. Quote, "I will fight for a federal law that helps communities establish gang-free zones with curfews on specific gang members, a ban on gang-related clothing, and the specific legal authority to break violent teen gangs once and for all." By 2000, the U.S. prison population had reached 2 million, with no sign of slowing. Yet public opinion has been shifting, both on the death penalty and on the war on drugs. A sizable chunk of the population believes there are serious flaws in the justice system. In January 2000, the Republican governor of Illinois, a supporter of capital punishment, suspended the death penalty in his state because he no longer thought it could be fairly administered. In the late 1990s, New York and Los Angeles were in uproar over racist, trigger-happy, and corrupt cops. The federal agent's armed snatch of Elian Gonzalez from his relative's home in Miami's Little Havana prompted cries of outrage from lawmakers who had glibly signed on to the repressive Clinton-Gore anti-crime measures. They now were denouncing the jackboot state, alerting mainstream America to the fact that the Bill of Rights had disappeared, restrictions on the role of the military in domestic affairs have been thrown overboard, and all the appurtenances of a police state have been put in place. Upon the removal of Elian, House Speaker Dennis Hastert proclaimed sternly, "Our government has invaded the home of American citizens who deserve the protection of our laws and a certain respect for their rights." In a foolish spasm of opportunism, Gore sided with Miami relatives in the Alion case and doubled back after the raid as he saw poll numbers climb in favor of Alion's return to his father. For blacks and Hispanics, the reactions of some pundits and politicians — Chris Matthews expended his usual lung power on that topic — to that famous photograph of Alion face to face with the gun of a federal agent was comic in a macabre sort of way. They had been putting up with these no-knock, forcible entries by heavily armed police or INS agents for decades. On the far right, fears about the onrush of tyranny had hardened into certainty back at the time of Waco. The week before the Alion raid, the left saw the state in action against their demonstrations in Washington, D.C., against the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. Here's how Sam Smith, longtime Washington reporter and editor of the Progressive Review, evoked the events unfolding in the Capitol in April. Illegal sweep arrests. Print shops intimidated into closing by police. Universities canceling public forums under pressure from officials. Homes of opposition leaders broken into and ransacked. Headquarters of the opposition raided and closed by police. These were the sorts of things by which we defined the evil of the old Soviet Union, and now they become characteristics of the federal government's handling of the current protests. In Washington, as in Seattle during the protests against the World Trade Organization, the treatment of arrested people made for hair-raising reading, with random beatings, denials of food and water for 24 hours, racial abuse, threats of rape, refusals to allow consultations with attorneys. As in the 1960s, white middle-class demonstrators and their parents are learning what happens to poor people all the time. Mainstream politicians were not a whit perturbed by police conduct in Seattle or Washington, D.C. Both parties have eagerly conjoined in militarizing the police, extending police powers, and carving away basic rights. Often, the Democrats have been worse. It was Republican Representative Henry Hyde of Illinois who led the partially successful charge in 1999 against the seizure of assets in drug cases. It was Democratic Senator Charles Schumer of New York who was the factotum of the Justice Department in trying to head off Hyde and his coalition. The rise of the jackboot state has marched in lockstep with the insane and ineffective war on drugs, and this has been a bipartisan affair. Its consequences are etched into the fabric of our lives. Just think of drug testing, now a virtually mandatory condition of employment, even though it's an outrageous violation of personal sovereignty, as well as being thoroughly unreliable. In an era in which America has been led by two self-confessed pot smokers, Clinton and Gore, the number of people held for drug crimes in federal prisons has increased by 64%. No-knock raids are becoming more common as federal, state, and local politicians and law enforcement agencies decide that the war on drugs justified dumping the Fourth Amendment. Even in states where search warrants require a knock on the door before entry, police routinely flout the requirement. The Posse Comitatus Act, forbidding military involvement in domestic law enforcement, is rapidly becoming as dead as the Fourth Amendment. Because of drug war exceptions created in that act, every region of the United States now has a joint task force staff in charge of coordinating military involvement in domestic law enforcement. In many cases, street deployment of paramilitary units is funded by, quote, community policing grants from the federal government. Scott Kennedy, take note. The majority of police departments use their paramilitary units to serve dynamic entry search warrants. The SWAT team in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, conducted a large-scale crack raid of an entire block in a predominantly African-American neighborhood. The raid, termed Operation Ready Rock, resulted in the detention and search of up to 100 people, all of whom were black. Whites were allowed to leave the area. No one was ever prosecuted for a crime. In Albany, New York, not long before the change of venue trial there, of the four white cops who had killed Amadou Diallo in the Bronx, police in camouflage uniforms went on a ransacking spree in the black neighborhood of Arbor Hill, beating down doors house to house in search of a black suspect. Right now, the swelling jackboot state is an expression of the war on drugs. No politician who does not call for a ceasefire and a rollback in that cruel feudal war, our domestic Vietnam, has any standing to bewail the loss of our freedoms. There are signs of popular mutiny. In 2000, the ACLU and the National Rifle Association jointly called for President Clinton to appoint a commission to investigate lawlessness in law enforcement. States with democratic processes such as ballot initiatives have seen brave efforts to curb the drug war. Meanwhile, Al Gore has consistently called for a widening of police powers, an intensification of that war, a whittling away of the Bill of Rights. Where there is no social program, there's always a violence program. For the Clinton-Gore administration, welfare reform and expansion of the police state were not only the means to trump the Republicans, they were also essential to economic policy. Intense competition for jobs at the lowest rungs would depress wages, pit poor and working-class people against each other, and where workfare recipients displace municipal workers, weaken unions. The specter and reality of incarceration would have the traditional effect of suppressing the dangerous classes at a time when the gap between rich and poor grew wider than at any time in recent history. A side benefit would be that all these prisoners would brighten the statistical profile of Clintonomics since they aren't figured into the unemployment rates. Gore's campaign 2000 continued to prescribe the medicine of Clinton time while advancing its candidate as the co-author of the policies that had supposedly worked wonders of prosperity for the majority over the past 8 years. In New Left Review for May-June 2000, Robert Polin, an economist at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, published an anatomy of Clintonomics, and it did not offer much comfort to those trying to run the lesser of two evils flag up the pole one more time. Polin concluded his survey thus: "The core of Clinton's economic program has been global economic integration, with minimum interventions to promote equity in labor markets or stability in financial markets. Gestures to the least well-off have been slight and backhanded, while wages for the majority have either stagnated or declined. Wealth at the top, meanwhile, has exploded. But a stratospheric rise in stock prices and a debt-financed consumption spree make for a mortgaged legacy. Clinton will hand over to his successor the most precarious financial pyramid of the post-war epoch." Polin detailed the record. "Clinton has done virtually nothing to advance the interests of working people or organized labor." What about the two-step rise in the minimum wage? Answer: the overall rise from $4.25 to the current $5.15 set in September 1997, I think it's gone up more since then, has done little to offset the plunge in the real value of the minimum wage. By Polin's calculations, $5.15 is 30% below its real value in 1968, even though the economy has become 50% more productive across that 30 years. How about anti-poverty programs? Polin looked at all the claims made by the administration for the glories of the earned income tax credit, offset those against the destruction of aid to families with dependent children, now known as Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, TANF, factored in the decline of the number of people getting food stamps, five times greater than the decline of the number of people in poverty, and spelled out the conclusion. The combination of a low minimum wage and a widening of the earned income tax credit have allowed business to offer rock-bottom wages while shifting onto taxpayers the cost of alleviating the poverty of even those holding full-time jobs. Nor could it be said that under Clinton Gore, organized labor enjoyed much of a renaissance. In 1988, Reagan's last year, the percentage of the total workforce in unions stood at 16.8. In 1998, it had fallen to 13.9. It has since risen, but not to anywhere near its rate during the union-busting days under Reagan. Despite Gore's avowed concern for labor rights, workers have not had an easier time forming unions, winning certification elections, negotiating first contracts, or striking under Clinton Gore, nor have employers had a harder time decertifying unions. In terms of compensation, both the average wages of non-supervisory workers and the earnings of those in the lowest tenth on the wage distribution scale remain, according to Polin, well below those of the Nixon, Ford, and Carter administrations, and are also lower than those of the Reagan-Bush years. Wage inequalities have also shot up. If low rates of unemployment had been a positive feature of the 1990s, Pollan wrote, it is quite possible that the overall condition of the poor will prove still to have worsened in Clinton's final year in office. And that's a chapter from Al Gore, A User's Manual by Alexander Coburn and Jeffrey St. Clair, a book you can find in the Capitola Book Cafe, or possibly Logos. I don't recommend either Borders or Bookshop Santa Cruz. Don't recommend Borders because it is a chain that strangles local stores. And I don't recommend Bookshop Santa Cruz because it's owned by a man who, as city council member and as mayor, moved to end civil rights for poor people on the streets in terms of a whole series of downtown ordinances, which neither Mayor Sugar nor Councilmember Crone nor any of the candidates except for Steve Argue that I can think of have come out against. We have a call.
Hi, you're on free radio.
Hey, I was looking for Skidmark Bob.
I'm sorry?
Skidmark Bob, is he around?
Well, you're on the air, actually.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, you might try calling the voicemail.
All right.
All righty.
Thank you.
He's not around.
But you're around, so if you want to get on in touch in the final minutes of this show, we only got about 4 minutes left before our next talk show hosts come in. And I'm looking to find them in case they've left a tape in the studio, and I don't see any tape. Give a call to 427-3772. A reminder this afternoon from 2 to 5, if you're interested in the sleeping ban and planning some actions so that there will be some real pressure on the new city council, whoever those new council members are, Loudon Nelson, 2 to 5, there is a scheduled meeting of activists, and that might interest you. If you can't make that meeting, give a call to 423-HUFF, the phone number for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, and that's also the number you can call if you want information on stuff you've heard on the air that you might want to know more about. If you want yourself to be on the air or to make some response to something you've heard on the show today, or if you're just interested in civil rights for folks on the street or folks near the street, because that's the name of the game with HUFF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. There may or may not be a meeting of Residentes Unidos tomorrow. That's the organization which formed initially by Lee tenants and also joined by tenants of the Dolphin, which effectively raised their voices so strongly against the planned low-income housing project that would evict people and deny them the right to return to their homes, that is now being has been financed by the city to the tune of $1.5 million in a giveaway to Mercy Charities Housing that happened last Tuesday, where Mercy Charities Housing, I guess they're also called Mercy Housing California, took over the Dolphin apartment building. As part of this obscene project, you also have the demolition plan of the Rex Court apartments right across the street. Residentes Unidos normally meets on Monday night at 7 o'clock or so, but we may be shifting that time, and if you want to get clearer information, do give a call to 423-HUFF tomorrow on Monday for the final word on when that meeting will be happening. The Homeless Working Group, a group of homeless activists and some homeless people, has been meeting at the Chamber of Commerce headquarters at the Holiday Inn with Michael Schmidt being part of that group. Michael is the CEO for the area Chamber of Commerce. He is actually one of the few local businessmen slash politicians. He's not a politician, but if you consider the whole community, which includes politicians, he's been one of the few people, other than the old-time activists, who've been willing to stand up and speak about the need for safe sleeping places, the need to have clear stats on violence against the homeless, the need to take some real actions, and he's also played host to organizing with his weekly meetings of the Homeless Working Group. We will be meeting next Friday at 7 o'clock in the morning, all you early birds, at Tastings Restaurant, which is the restaurant inside the Holiday Inn. Bring a buck for coffee or come prepared to panhandle. That's 7 o'clock next Friday. I guess that's on the 10th at Tastings Restaurant for the Homeless Working Group. A couple of spare comments. The latest issue of Fish Rap Live, or what I call Fish Crap Jive, is an interesting issue. I don't actually have it here present with me, so I'm going to speak more from memory. It has a series of endorsements in it, which include, well, on the back cover is an ad with Rotkin as treasurer for an organization which supports, I guess, Kennedy and Hernandez as two of the candidates. And that's fine. Mike Rotkin can seek his old colleagues again to return to the council in a paid ad. There's no problem. But Rotkin is also the head of Fish Rap Live magazine. That is to say, he's the faculty advisor that is organizing this. He's called Dictator in the little kind of selection or itemization of who's on the magazine and who runs the magazine. In the center of Fish Rap Live this time has a series of endorsements, and the endorsements aren't that good even in and of themselves, but if you look at the ballot, and there's a kind of a copy of a